Check out our video tutorial on the HorseBills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. HorseBills.com. Toll-free number 888-938-4643.
Now, back to At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
We're back, and that was entertainment. Rich Migliore and Tony Black, between them, almost 10,000 wins in their careers. And I'd have to spend some time on Equibase to add up all of the career wins where Ed Seltzer's name is tied in, because he's got, over the years, has had so many different partners. Most recently, of course, and on a regular basis, you hear me mention Ed Seltzer and Bev Anderson. They're homebreds and still winning races at the highest level. And on Saturday, came close to a double graded stake with RS2, second in the Royal Delta, but Hibiscus Punch at a big price. We talked to Justin Nixon earlier, and Ed Seltzer joins us. It's been way too long. Ed, congratulations to you and Bev.
Thank you very, very much. Good to talk to you.
It's been way too long, and I told everybody that you were going to be on, and I think back to early days of the show, and you were literally one of the first owner breeders that I had on the show, and have followed with interest and root for you guys openly. And it seems to me, from a limited number, Ed, that you and Bev are having as much success as you've ever had.
Well, I think that I don't know that it ever gets any better. And you know what happens is that it's an incredible business where you have ups and downs, and you just have to learn to live with it and take the time to get to where you're going. You know that. I don't have to explain that to you.
Well said. And, in terms of one of the things that you've really done, and I want you to kind of lay it out a little bit, is you've been a careful manager of your broodmare band, and you've been able to adjust to the ebbs and flows of the breeding game, and the kinds of stallions that come along, and it just seems like you've been able to move to the right beat of the band.
Well, I think to a great extent, I think that's probably some truth in it. You spend a lot of time. We've never really had the kind of money to spend to do a lot of the things to buy. We've never bought expensive horses.
Right.
We've always bought pedigrees that we loved, and then spent the time to create something from those families. I caught a break not too long ago by making a deal with Spendthrift, and I wound up buying 10 Intermischief seasons a year for a while, and they gave me a big break in the beginning. So
wow.
I kind of caught that one a little bit. But but for the most part, it's just a fun game. It's a wonderful game. And I've been in it for 62 years, so I don't even want to tell you what that means. But anyway, it's just been fun.
I wasn't going to ask, Ed. Because it does seem like you've been in it and forever. And when I go look at the families, I mean, I want to talk about Harbor Club and
right.
Hibiscus Punch's family and go back. But that's part of what's amazing is that I'll start to track families back, and you'll go back three mares, four mares sometimes.
We've got five or six generations now, believe it or not.
Amazing. When you started, talk about your initial approach and how it changed and how it morphed.
Well, what happened, to tell you the truth, when I was right out of college, I had no money. I graduated, from school. I had a football scholarship, but I had no money. I was at a card game with a group of guys, And one guy came to the table and said he bought an eighth of a horse for $500 that I want half. And I had never been to a horse race in my life. I'd never seen one. I never knew anything about them. I said, yeah. Anyway, the venture was a disaster. I fell in love with it. And I've been in it ever since. And you start out claiming and you start out doing that and learning things and realizing that horses are bred for the grass. Nobody believed that. And then, you know, eventually when your life gets a little different and the world is different, you start breeding. And that's just the next level. And it's very tough. And it's it has its ups and downs. I don't have to tell you that.
Well, let's go back. I want to go. Let's start with college. Where'd you grow up and where'd you play football?
I grew up in Chicago. And I had a wonderful football coach that told me some lovely things. And I wound up doing fairly well on the SATs. And I wound up getting the scholarship to Harvard. don't even ask. Anyway. But, you know, the wonderful thing about that is you talk about how your life is lucky. If I had tried to get a scholarship to Illinois or Northwestern or, you know, even Florida, I wasn't even close to being good enough. But, you know, when you Harvard, you don't have to be that good to play ball. And as long as you can read, it works out. So that's how it was.
Well, then the next logical question is what years did you play and how many times did you beat Yale?
Well, we beat Yale twice, but I played. I got hurt my second year. I couldn't play anymore, and I also got nervous because I wound up one day going to a park there, and there were some guys throwing a softball around, and I knew how to do that. And so I could throw an underhand softball pretty fast. And so I played ball for these guys, and they paid me. And I got to be a nervous wreck because, you know, at that time, you couldn't take money and play ball. But then I got hurt, so I couldn't play ball anymore. But I kept playing the softball for these guys in a little square in Cambridge. So it was a lot of fun, and I made enough money to get through school.
So you're one of these guys that got to a place like Harvard on a scholarship and then had the opportunity to go ahead and get an education at Harvard and off you went.
And yeah, and you know the funny thing about it is I think I learned a great deal. I think I got some very great advice from a lot of people that I knew there. I don't know that my education or what I ever did it got me through anything, but I think it does. You know, in your own way, you learn stuff, whether it's from your friends or the people you know. But it was a great time.
When you got involved with the horses at that point, Ed Seltzer is with us, and of course he and Bev Anderson and Ed takes on they take on different partners, and I think your daughter as well.
Well, Bev is my wife now.
Right. Yes. Yes.
I married Beverly, I married her 5 years ago, but we've been together 15 years.
Yes, and you talk about the development of starting to go to the races, and you know, you've also had a very good instinct, it seems to me, Ed, picking trainers. You invariably are involved with real horsemen and not necessarily mainstream names.
No, you know, the first time when I wound up with horses and the first time, I didn't like what was going on, so I went to try to find a trainer. And I called a bunch of people when I said I had one horse worth this much. Everybody hung up. So I wound up calling Slim Pierce, and he told me that his son had been a jock's agent and that he was going to Florida for 3 or 4 weeks, and he would train for me up until the time that they came back to Chicago, and then I would have to find someone else. And so when he called me to tell me he was coming back and he would send me a check, I said, no, we'll have dinner. And at that time, I was going with and then married my wife, the mother of my children, who passed away, you know, in 1980.
Sure.
and I lost a son before that. So Joe and I went to dinner, and I had a few martinis, which I probably shouldn't have. And anyway, I talked him into training for me. It wasn't easy. And so he did, and we just had, Joe and I had an incredible run. We really had a good time. We claimed horses, we bought horses, and it was the best time, I think, that I could have had during that period of time. It was great. We had a wonderful time. And we won a lot of races.
And you won some big races. I mean, I want to think, you know, the Midwest, Chicago and Monmouth Park. And,
well, you know, the first or second year, I think, 1962, which wasn't it? It was about 3 years. I claimed a horse called El Bandito for $10,000, and we won the Arlington Handicap.
Hmm.
And that was the first big, big race we had. And, and then we won a few others. But it was really, it was just one of those times when the world was different and racing was different and people were different. And I was so fortunate to find Joe. And then Joe and his family moved to New Jersey and I stayed in Chicago.
Okay. Because so I know he...
Yeah. I wound up getting lucky. I can't even tell you how lucky. And yet it was a strange time. I met Harry Trotsik. And that was the most incredible experience of my life. He was the most wonderful man I'd ever known. I mean, he was like a father to me when my son died, when my wife died. And he was the best horseman I've ever known. Alec Hargill told me one day that Harry would have been the best in the world if he wasn't a gyp. But that's just what he was. He was funny, but he... But he was just wonderful.
What were you, business-wise, what were you doing? What were you doing when you weren't paying attention to the races?
Well, I was, of course, I was in the automobile business. I got lucky, and somebody helped me get into that thing. And I was going to go to school, and then I decided I didn't really want to get the deferment and have to come back. So I decided to get drafted. I got out of. When I graduated school and not go to graduate school. And then when I went to get inducted, they did some x-rays and they found out that I couldn't hang from one of those obstacle courses because my shoulders were bad from playing ball. they said to me, you know, if you want, we'll get you a ticket to go back. I said, I'll take a cab. I couldn't wait to go home. And I found a woman and a man, and they helped me get into the business, and we did that for a while. And then, you know, you do something else, and we moved here, and I mean, the world just changes, and you do different things. And to tell you the truth, the way the things are, everything is strange, because in 1975, I lost a 9-year-old son.
Mm.
And so, you know, I didn't know what to do, and my wife was miserable, and so and she became ill. So I sold everything I had, which wasn't that much at the time. And actually, I was going to sell the horses, and I just couldn't bring myself to, but I didn't have that many. But anyway, I didn't know what to do, and I was living in my wife's room at the hospital because she was very ill. And somebody came up, and they wanted me to buy this piece of property in South Florida. And I said, I'll take it. So I took a look at it. I fell in love with it. It was a slum down there then. But I bought it, and I figured, you know, it's 4 or 5 years between now and then. We'll see what it looks like, and then I'll sell it. And that was in 78. And I just finally sold that property 5 years ago. And it was the most incredible experience of my life. We built it up. We made a wonderful place out of it. There was a hotel and retail. The retail people are my best friends. And you just meet people that you'd never believe you did. And we still are close to them. And 5 years ago, I sold it because we were living on the farm here and my wife couldn't travel anymore. She got a bad back from, she was a world-class skier and she hurt herself. So we finally decided to sell it. It was very hard to do, but it was worth a lot of money at that point, more than I ever I'm okay now. Whatever that means.
Well, and for anybody that hasn't figured it out yet, Ed Seltzer's had something of a charmed existence, it seems, right? Is that fair?
You go through bad stuff, you go through good stuff. When I look back at my life, and I do that frequently, I'm very fortunate to be where I am, doing what I'm doing, living where I live, and all of the things that go with it. Have there been miserable times? Yes, there have been. But I don't think you can be 86 years old and not go through that stuff. So that's what it is.
Well, you sound fabulous. And, you know, I'm looking.
I feel good.
Yeah, you sound great. And I mentioned Harbor Club and the success. I want you to concentrate on Hibiscus Punch and tell everybody how this comes about, because it starts out with a nice mare. Speaking of Harry Trotzik, you know, here is over your shoulder. And, you know, that's sort of the beginning of this story.
Well,
and right?
Yeah, and the funny part about it is that Harbor Club, I bought her. Well, I actually bred Over Your Shoulder, and we bought the mare, Carnet Solaire. We bought her at Keeneland, and we brought her home, and we raced her, and then we bred Over Your Shoulder, and then Harbor Club, and then we went on. And that family has been with us all those years. And Tommy Skippington trade Harbor Club.
I was going to say, and, you know, from Trotzik, here's Skiff Dog, and then Bellini Sunrise, Rodney Jenkins. I mean, this is
right.
Danny Vella. I mean, and Kieran. I mean, you seem to have instinctually, you know, found real horsemen and not necessarily, you know, the household names of the moment.
Well, and, you know, I think, well, I don't have to tell you. You know, it's just the game has changed. It's changed when trainers and horsemen or trainers and owners were friends, and we had dinner together and we spent time together, and they had 15 horses or 18, not 300.
Yeah.
And you know, it's a different game for those guys. I mean, it really is. When you first get back into it and you start dealing with them, you realize that you're a number anymore. I can't blame them because that's what they do for a living. I can't blame anybody that wants to grow. But it's the same with me. I think if my business ever were to get that big, I don't want to do it anymore. I wouldn't want to have, like when I had my hotel and my tenants, I wouldn't want to have 20 of them because then everybody would be a number. I'm different. I just have to have a feeling. And so that's why Harry was so wonderful, or Joe Pierce, or all of those guys. Rodney never wanted to. He just wanted to be where he was.
Yes. Yeah.
Rodney's a good guy.
And one of our favorites. You know, had Woodbury last week. This close
Tommy
friend.
And I had Harbor Club. She went off by herself, and he spent time, I mean seriously so, teaching her to relax so she would get a distance of ground. Nobody ever thought she could because she won her first start with 6 furlongs, and she looked like that's all she could do. And he really did an incredible job. I think Tommy was meant to be really, really good. I think his life just changed a little bit by certain things in his life. But I think he could have been really a brilliant horseman. Not that he wasn't, but I mean, he could have gone out to be something really, really special.
Well, you know, like all steeplechase guys, they fall on their head a few times, and so you know.
Yeah. Well, the same thing with football players. That's why I have my problem.
Well, and Rodney too. Rodney's also a chase guy. Came out of that school. One of the things about this too that when I bring up. You know, Harbor Club and Bellini Sunrise, and now this mare. She's 6 years old, Ed, and a lot of people would have given up and would have, you know, just taken her nice pedigree and put her in the shed. But between you and Justin Nixon, you'd now have been really rewarded to get this nice mare with the, you know, with graded black type.
Well, yeah. I mean, well, yeah. Well, She looked like a pretty nice filly when she was in Canada. And then she got her, she came home. We gave her a year. She came back there and she ran a big race. And we ran her back in a stake that looked like she could get a piece of it. And she was second in that one.
Right.
I was very, very pleased. But it looked good. And then there was an allowance race came up, and it would have been nice to get some money. So we did. And then we decided to run her in this because they thought it was going to come up with five or six, and the weather looked terrible. And I figured if you're ever going to get graded black type, it would be when nobody wants to show up. But then they postponed it. They waited a week. Pretty soon we had a full field. And you know, to be very honest with you, I would have been so thrilled to be third. If I would tell you that I thought we had a chance to win, not a chance. I mean, I just wanted to be third. When she turned for home and opened up, I was sitting here with my wife. I couldn't believe it.
So neither.
And when that happens, you know, I'm 3 days enjoying that day. I'm so enjoying it.
Well, and of course, hours later, you almost win with RS2 with Arno Delacour. You almost win the stake at Florida.
And you know, we really thought she was going to win it when she turned for home. She looked like she got a little unfocused and she was lugging in a little bit. We'll figure out. But you know, I thought she was going to win it when I was watching the race. I really did. But she got beat. But it's okay. After this, you can't complain about anything. You're whine, you're foolish. So
And RS2, we should mention, you know, she's already got graded stake. You know, she had...
won that race at Laurel, and she won the one before. So she's... And, you know, the pricing on the cake, you know, a filly... The funny thing is that mare has never given me... Oh, she only gave me that one filly, and then she shut down a little bit. She's been 4 years empty. And so, you know, I'm trying to get her back in full, and she's not a child anymore. But I sold a filly out of her called Pangburn.
Oh, yeah.
Who was the first one. Yeah, and she's got Caddo River.
Yes.
So, the pedigree continues to be attractive.
Wow. Unbelievable. Explain, you've got infinite patience. Obviously, you held on to that property for 50 years. But explain the patience to stick with a mare that, you know, that is barren 4 years in a row. And,
the idea, when you've got a mare that you love, and she's done well, and we really like her, it's true love, and, you know, she lost a couple of foals, one because of the virus in Kentucky and one here. You know, it just, it happens. But you don't give up on them. I mean, you can't. And what are you going to do with them? I mean, I have a farm here. One of the things that I'm blessed and I can do is I have a place for retirees. You know, land isn't very terribly expensive. And we can turn them out and you can look at them every day. And
sure.
It's wonderful to find another home for some of them where they can be jumpers. It's no different than a dog or a cat or anything else. If you buy them and you own them, they're yours. And you have to take care of them, and you have to make sure they have a decent life. You own them. They can't make that decision.
Well, and that, you know, that's an obligation, and that you take that on. It's incredibly responsible of you and Bev to have approach it that way.
Do you think it's any different? And I mean, if you can afford to have a horse and you can afford to do this, then you can afford that. If you can't, then you shouldn't do it. Now, it's like having a dog. I mean, if you've got a dog, and then when they get old and you don't want to take care of them anymore, you put them out in the street, you can't do that. I mean, there's certain things that are honorable and certain things that aren't.
Well said. I want to give you a chance too, Ed, since you're referencing a number, you know, different parts of an operation. Talk about who you've worked with, who gets your horses ready, and who's the team that's involved.
Well, you know, the funny thing is, I bought this farm in I think 2005, 2006. And I was buying it, And somebody had recommended it to me. And so I was buying it. And I had a guy call me and say, would you do us a favor? He's saying this out loud, but and keep the farm manager on for a month or two. And I said, well, you know, I hadn't really planned on it. It's not what I, why? And he said, well, that way we could avoid severance. I don't want you, I didn't even want to tell you how long you worked. Anyway, at the end of the day, I flew into town and I met him. And I said to him, you know this farm is for sale. He said, no, I thought you were just looking at it. I said, no. I flew into town a week later and had lunch and dinner with him. And he's been here ever since. Steve, he is the best day's work I've ever done in my life.
Unbelievable.
He is the most incredible talent and honor and faithful and loyal. I wouldn't have a farm without him anymore. I couldn't. And his name is Curtis Garrison. He's the most wonderful man I've ever known. I mean that sincerely. I've been blessed with a lot of great people, and he's one of them.
Yeah, and Justin, you know, earlier Justin Nixon was on with us, and he talked about, you know, his interplay too with Curtis and how how Hibiscus came up from the farm, and you know he said when Curtis says, she's half mile fit, that's exactly what she is. He said.
The thing about Justin is a great guy, and I'm just really beginning to know him well. I met him through a partner, a friend, and I now know him. And he's got such a great mentality. And I don't say it because he trains for me now. I mean it because he's a good man. He's a good guy. He does the right thing, not only in training, but in his life. And I think that's important. I mean, I think you should reach a point where if the person you're dealing with isn't a proper person in their life, then they're probably not a proper person, period. I don't know why, but I think it's true.
Undoubtedly. And, you know, it's funny, earlier when you talked about, working with trainers and going to dinner and so forth, it reminds me of Tommy Kelly told me and said something in an interview once that's always stayed with me. And he said, when you pick a trainer, you're buying a friend. So make sure that it's somebody you want to be with and you want to spend time with and you want to go to dinner with, everything you said. And that's a part of the game and the process of selecting a trainer to work with or a manager a stable manager. It have it be somebody that you really have a bond with, that you have a connection to,
and you have to trust them.
Exactly, that's the bond, that's what makes it work.
Because there's so many ways that they can or you can violate those trusts because you don't see each other every day. And to be very honest with you, I'm not really a horseman. I tell you that's the truth. I can't look at a horse. I've never been able to. And I know that. They did an article about me years ago. I had a horse called Barely Even who was really a good filly.
Oh, yeah.
And I was at the farm when they were doing it. They brought her by, and they want a picture of me. And then 10 minutes later, she walked by again, and I said, who's that? I said, Barely Even. No one believes I can't look at a horse. I truly cannot look at a horse. I mean, my daughter can look at one. Curtis, I cannot look. My wife can look at one. I can't. I'm not visual. I just really can't. But it doesn't keep me from doing what I do.
No. No.
It doesn't keep me from the pedigrees, and it doesn't keep me from the things. And what breaks my heart, I think, a little bit is what's happening to racing today. I don't like the way it's going. I can't change it. You know, I'm not at a point where I can. But I think maybe we're going in the wrong direction. The gambling is very important, but it shouldn't be all there is. You watch RTN or you watch this and you watch that, and all they talk about is gambling. They don't talk about the horse. They don't talk about the love, the excitement, the winning of a race, that kind of stuff.
you know, this is an interesting area, and you know, when it comes to the sportsman mentality and the kind of affection and connection that you're talking about, it is part of the sport, Ed, that is not, it really is not the same. Whenever these conversations come up, I mean, obviously, you know, there's the Claibornes and Dill Schneiders and Hancocks and, you know,
right.
somebody like Charlotte Weber, who I'm sure you know well. And
of course,
the Phipps family with and Stu Janney, and the way those people have kept the game and kept their involvement alive. But it, you know, the commercial part is the engine on the train these days. And I don't think it shouldn't be to the detriment of the sport overall.
No. And you know, I was thinking the other day, they're talking about creating and bringing people into the business. So, you know,
yes.
You talk about young people, you want them to come in, but you know, they have cell phones, they go to, they're not interested in this. If you took something like the Villages, retirement communities, older people that, you know, not dying. I mean, you know, these are people who have 20 years or 30 years left in their life. They're widowers. They have nothing to do. They have nothing in there. And so, you know, are they Claiborne? No. Are they rich? Not necessarily. They have enough. I mean, nobody that should be in the horse business should be broke. But what I mean is you can get 10 people to own a horse.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be an expensive horse. And you can have parties, and you can have RTN, and you can have dinners, and you can meet each other and get to know each other. I tell you, Justin was telling me the other day, I don't know if he told you, but his mother's 80. Now, I'm not looking for her to be an owner, but what I mean is she never really paid attention. And now all of a sudden, because Justin has some nice horses, she's learning about it. She's got an iPad. She watches the races. She loves it. It's giving her a whole new lease on life. He told me the other day, she's acting like she's 5 years younger. Now, you know, really and truly think about it. It's the older people, you know, even like a place like the Villages, they can meet each other. Who knows what happens from there?
It doesn't have to be
young kids. Australia's doing this. Australia has 10, 15 people on a horse. Why not?
The clubs, they've got the club concept too, that and the European, and there's been some movement on that front. You know,
the
racetracks themselves have taken that up. The Churchill Downs Racing Club, the Empire Racing Club. I mean, virtually every oval now has got the low, you know, one-time payment, and then there's the micro share concept. Of course, you know, you mentioned the deal you made with B. Wayne Hughes. I mean, look at what B. Wayne, he's obviously got that same mentality that there's got to be a way to, you know, bring the game to a wider audience.
And, you know, the other part of it is when you take retirement communities and places like that, they revel in this. I mean, they can sit down in an afternoon, watch two races and
it's
watch
an activity.
And have lunch and enjoy themselves. They can come to a small, we have a little farm, and they can come to the little farm and enjoy themselves and come in a minibus and spend the day looking at babies or watching horses train. You know, it's fun.
You know what, Ed, it's funny. Everything you read and every initiative is, we got to bring in the 20 and 30 somethings. And you bring up a great point when you say that, you know, the life expectancy is actually extended, and you've got people that have exactly what we're looking for, which is expendable income and leisure time.
And they can't get out. A lot of them can't go anywhere.
And there you go. They're a captive audience.
Well, you know, the funny part about it, it sounds funny to say that, but Steve, do you know how long it's been since I've really been to a race?
Well,
I don't enjoy it that much. RTN has changed my life about racing. I watch every race. I can watch them warm up. I can watch the whole thing.
Yep.
I don't have to be with someone I don't like. And it, when it's done, I can have a drink with my wife, or I can turn it off if I don't want to have to fly 200 miles to go home and be miserable because I got beat. So it works out. But I have a little gal that I stand a little horse with her because I have one that I want to.
Talk about this. Talk about Rogish.
Oh, okay. I didn't know you knew about it.
Justin told us.
Oh, okay. Well, anyway, I had a horse that I ran the first time as a two-year-old in the fairgrounds. And Steve Asmussen had. And he ran out of the picture. I mean, really a big number. He was great. And I was thrilled. And I was getting huge offers for him. And Steve called me and said, don't do that. He said, you know, it's 2 or 2.5 minutes. He said, the next time he runs, you'll win a stake and you'll get whatever you want. I really don't want to sell him. I'd rather sell a piece, whatever. He worked him in the mud one day and he bowed. So I brought him home and we gave him some time. And it didn't look like he was going to get back to where he was or even close. So there was a woman that I knew that had been down on her luck and had a real tough time. And she wanted to stand him. And I said, okay. Anyway, she had him at 2 or 3 different places. And the guy kept throwing her off. And this one threw her off. And this guy treated her bad, whatever. You know, that's what happens when they get somebody that's vulnerable. I don't have to tell you what that is. So I went out and was looking for a farm for her to lease. And I found this little place. So I bought it. It's a small farm, 60 acres. So anyway, Rogish is there. Now, last year was his first year. He covered about 40 mares. But, you know, in Florida, first of all, the breeding program sucks. And secondly, you know, it's hard to get anyone to breed to anybody. So she did a good job. And in the meantime, over a period of a year, his family blew up. He didn't, but... You know, we had a filly called Lucretia that's a full sister that was a multiple group winner. Then Into the Sunrise winds up winning a stake and then being fourth in the Breeders' Cup. And then now Hibiscus and 2 or 3 other things. And so Rogish all of a sudden is not a household word. But the good part of it is he's also by Into Mischief. So he's the only Into Mischief in play. You know, everybody wanted him. And so we decided to do it, and we're getting some play on him. But it's a good pedigree, and, you know, so it's going to be fun. I would love to see her do well. She's really a lovely little thing, and she's working hard, and she doesn't know how to do anything but work. So it's nice. I went yesterday to a stallion show that she had. It was cute. It was nice. Her sister did the food. It was good. I shouldn't have eaten as much as I did, but...
What a cool story. It's Rogish, and Rogish with an E, Rogueish. And
the misspelling, by the way, is my fault.
That's all right, actually. You wouldn't have gotten it otherwise, because there was a Rogueish, you know, without an E. That
I didn't know that. I mean, I honestly, God made the mistake. So,
well, he's right in
Citra. I probably made more than I should. My spelling is not perfect. Beverly's is good. Mine's not good.
Stormborn Stallions. He stands for 2,500. And you know what's amazing about this? We started the conversation, and Hibiscus Punch was part of the, you know, the focus. This is also a son that comes, if you look at the tail female, Harbor Club.
Yeah.
Harbor Club is here, too.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah.
Unbelievable. And this, you know, I'm just looking at him, you know, that Verdana Bold by Rahi. So he's going to get turf horses if that's in the works. And
right.
Danny Vella had a lot of success with those two mares behind her. Wow. Dance Review and unbelievable. This is a nice pedigree.
It's been a lot of fun. I tell you, you can never, if you're in this business, it takes a hold of you and you don't want to ever give it up.
That's the problem with it.
Well, but it's either the good part or the bad part, isn't it?
I'm saying that tongue-in-cheek. Ed Seltzer has been with us. We're going to end up wrapping up here, Ed, but I also got to give you not only a chance to talk about Rogish, but sparkling review, the baby, Sparkle Plenty. It seems like Justin's very excited about.
Well, Sparkling Review, we had a very good run with her. And now we've got her first bowl is a two-year-old. Sparkle Plenty.
By Uncle Mo.
Sparkle Plenty is from Dick Tracy. Remember that?
Oh, God.
I don't know.
Yes. Yes, of course. It's funny. I saw that when he said the name, it rang a bell, and I'm thinking, why? And then I couldn't figure out why I knew the name.
Right.
That's great. Oh, my God. Ed. We could go on and on. Everybody that listens to the show hears me dote on Ed Seltzer and Bev Anderson, and now everybody knows why. Ed, continued success.
Is that 954 number? Are you in South Florida?
That's where the studio. I'm up at Saratoga, but the studio is in Margate. Yeah.
Okay.
But I'll be down. I think I may come down for OBS from OBS March and broadcast from the sale.
Do me a favor and call me when you come down.
Without fail,
please.
It's a deal.
Because I'll have my second shot by then.
Nice. I love it. Ed
okay.
Seltzer, Ed, stay well and stay safe, and we'll see you soon.
Talk to you soon. Thank you.
Tremendous. Ed Seltzer, everybody. And how infectious is that at 87? And amazing. Ed Seltzer, Tony Black, Rich Migliori, Jerry Robb, Justin Nixon. that was a lot of Monday, huh? Delta Downs, by the way, was the fourth racetrack. They're back running today. That's who we forgot earlier this morning. And Parks and Turf Paradise later as well. And Mahoning Valley with their new 15% takeout pick five they're introducing today. Tuesday at the races tomorrow. Lots more recapping and Andy Serling and more. Replay 6 to 9 here on SiriusXM. Archive, podcast, etc. I'm gonna go take a look at that king cake. Talk to you tomorrow. Thanks, everybody. Thanks, Deja.
Now back to At the Races with Steve Bick on SiriusXM Radio.
Welcome to Color Life. My name is Blue, and I'm a color lovely lady. Who are you? I don't do bars, the oxygen is missing. But I don't need to fit in, I just do what I do.
Closing time, one last call for alcohol. So finish your whiskey or beer.